joined by my colleagues, Judges Botfold and Larson. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this morning. We're ready for the next case on our calendar, which is State of Minnesota versus Andrew Donald Knott. The case number is A220402. And I see that we're joined by counsel arguing for both sides this morning. Good morning to you and welcome. The argument this morning is being held via the Zoom platform. Just a few words before I turn things over to counsel about that. I ask that if you're not the attorney speaking, you please keep your mute button on. We are making an audio recording of the argument this morning that will be available shortly on our website. And it will greatly help us if we don't have noise coming from someone else's speaker. I also ask that anyone watching the argument observe that courtesy as well. Counsel, before you begin your argument, please introduce yourself and the party you're representing. That will also help us with our recording. You can just nod to me if you see it. Do you see the calendar, or I'm sorry, the clock rather that is on the screen? Okay, that will be keeping track of your time this morning. Counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes. Counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have a 5-minute rebuttal. That concludes my remarks. Counsel, are you both ready to go?
I am, Your Honors.
Yes.
Okay. Then you may go ahead, counsel for appellant.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Christina Zahar, and I represent appellant Andrew Knott. This appeal stems from a criminal sexual conduct trial, which was replete of oddities and resulted in Mr. Knott being found guilty of sexually penetrating an unconscious woman in a small full-size bed that contained an additional sleeping man and yet another sleeping man on the floor, neither of whom awoke. The alleged act involved Mr. Knott allegedly dragging this unconscious woman from one side of the bed to the other, removing her tights, removing her skirt, having sexual intercourse with her, then putting her tights and skirt back on, again, all without waking the other man on the bed or the man on the floor. There is insufficient evidence at this trial that either the sexual penetration or contact occurred, and there's also insufficient evidence that the complainant was physically helpless or that Mr. Knott would have had reason to know that she was physically helpless. This is a case involving a high amount of circumstantial evidence, even according to the complainant's testimony. The complainant repeatedly testified and provided pre-trial statements to law enforcement and other people that the only reason she thought she was sexually assaulted was because of how her tights were not pulled all the way back up and her skirt was in a strange position as well. That is circumstantial evidence of the sexual assault. But for that, she repeatedly told multiple parties and testified at trial that she believed it was a dream or could have been a bad dream, but for the positioning of her tights, again, that she found not to be pulled all the way up when she woke up in the morning after a night of drinking with a group of individuals at this lodge or condo up in the Lutzen area. And so when we have a case that is so highly dependent on circumstantial evidence, the test for this court is to think about whether the circumstances proved are consistent with guilt and inconsistent with any other rational hypothesis other than guilt.
So counsel, will you help me with that specific argument? Give us some more detail on what you contend is the reasonable alternative hypothesis here.
So the reasonable alternative hypothesis is that the complainant was not sexually assaulted on this night. She completed a rape kit immediately that next morning. Not a single bit of DNA was found in her rape kit. There wasn't any stray hair.
You are going to talk about the sample that was taken from her tights. It matches your client's DNA.
Yes, I can address that. Absolutely. Yep. So that Yes, sure. I'll address that. I'll just briefly conclude summarizing about the rape kit. Nothing was found in that rape kit. So no DNA, no sperm, no semen, no skin cells, no hairs, no injuries.
So, counsel, I'm not convinced that the circumstantial evidence test applies, but I want to start with, you know, you accommodating or considering the direct evidence, and this sperm sample from your client that was found on the victim's tights is certainly a piece of direct evidence. So would your comments go to that question?
Yes. So on the victim's tights, this was near her knee. There was an area tested near the knee of the tight with a very small sperm cell fraction found on there. The expert from the BCA testified it was a small amount, not anywhere close to the amount of sperm that would be present with a full ejaculation, but rather a sperm cell fraction, again, found near the knee. And that expert also testified that when we're talking about DNA that's found on clothing, it is very common that that DNA be present due to incidental contact. So having clothing, having contact with multiple surfaces and people throughout the day. In this case, she slept in the bed that the defendant, Mr. Knott, had been sleeping in for several nights prior, and also slept in that night. Him and one of the other male friends at that party had been sharing that bed during their vacation there. And so she was in this bed that he had been in for multiple nights. She was using the same bathroom that he had been using for multiple days. She testified that she used the bathroom, so her tights presumably would have been pulled down to use the bathroom, would have touched the toilet, would have touched the floor of the bathroom. And these are all incidental ways that a small...
So counsel, it sounds to me like you're talking about transfer DNA. Is that, am I following
That's
you right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, you certainly mentioned it in your brief. So one of the things I need you to help me on, I didn't see it in your brief, is what evidence is in the record. And I'm talking about an explanation for the jury as to what transfer DNA is and how it would have happened in this case. You've now described a series of facts from which you hypothesize transfer DNA, but I didn't see any evidence really laying that out for the jury, that was presented as a theory during the trial. Did I miss that?
No, Your Honor, you didn't miss it. So that evidence would have come out during the direct examination of Bao King, the BCA expert. So that was the direct by the state. And that is when Bao King from the BCA testified about how the DNA that can be present on clothing, she used the word incidental. She didn't use the word transfer. That's the word that I used. But she used the word incidental contact with other surfaces and other people, and that it is extremely common, again, her words, that the DNA would come to be on an item of clothing due to having contact with either other surfaces or other people. That was also argued in my closing argument at well, where I went through that in detail with the jury, using that expert's testimony about how DNA cannot just become present from direct contact, in this case, a direct deposit of sperm directly onto a person's clothing. But she also talked about, again, her word was that incidental contact that can occur, especially when we're talking about such small amounts of DNA and sperm. Thank you.
So and I should look to the evidence of the state's expert from the BCA on forensic expert with regard to your theory on transfer DNA. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes, okay. Your Honor. We believe that the state's expert provided that scientific information that would be necessary for the jury to make those conclusions.
All right. And that supports your reasonable alternative hypothesis.
It does.
Okay. So let's talk about the evidence you haven't talked about. The victim's testimony is also direct evidence of sexual contact, penetration. Would you please address that? I understand that you would like to hypothesize it's a bad dream, but it is direct evidence of what happened, correct?
It is, well, if we go on that portion of the victim's testimony, what that cuts against is her testimony that she was physically helpless. So the state essentially has it, or is trying to argue it both ways. Either the victim remembers this incident in great detail, as a portion of her testimony would have outlined, which would cut against the theory that she was asleep or unconscious.
So or you need to help me, counsel. I don't see that sort of expert analysis of the victim's testimony in the record either. You're suggesting that she could not have a detailed memory and be physically helpless. And I'm struggling with that. What do you draw that from? You just your own common sense? I don't see it in the record.
So the definition of being physically helpless, of course, as we know, is that a person was either asleep or unconscious. If a person is asleep or unconscious, they would not have a detailed memory of an event. They'd be asleep and not present or conscious during it. Or they're unable to withhold consent or unable to verbally provide consent. And so using those definitions that we have from the actual statute and from the jury instruction, we were able to make those arguments as to whether the victim was actually physically helpless, given both her testimony as well as the testimony of her friend and the last person to speak with her, which would be the other man that was asleep in the bed with her prior to the defendant coming into the bed. So we have the testimony of her friend, which would have, she left presumably mere moments, minutes before this alleged assault occurred. And her friend testified that the complainant told her that she was just fine. She was going to stay there to sleep and that she was going to stay with her vehicle. And so we have that testimony of the complainant actually speaking clearly, describing why she's staying. And that is from the state's own witness. That is from her friend that would be supportive of her, the complainant.
And as I will clearly acknowledge, and I think you have too, there is a lot of conflicting evidence in this case. That's certainly true. So that's why I'm trying to hone in specifically on the direct evidence, because you're asking us to examine this under the circumstantial evidence test. And as I mentioned, I'm not convinced. So another piece of direct evidence is, and this goes to physical helplessness, your client's testimony that the victim was asleep and did not speak to him when he got into bed next to her. All right. So would you discuss that, please? So again, I how our legal standard works. We're first of all not even going to get to the reasonable alternative hypothesis as long as the direct evidence is there to prove the essential elements of the case. So thank you.
Yes. Yep. So my client, Mr. Knott, he did testify that when he got into the bed that night, she was asleep. He did not have any additional information about her state other than what he had observed throughout the night. And that was that she was up, she was walking, she was talking. She was not having a hard time, keeping control of herself physically or mentally. And that's what he had observed prior to going to bed. She was asleep before him, as were the other two men that were in the room. So there was the other man in the bed with the complainant, as well as the man on the floor. Regarding the direct evidence of what the complainant testified to, her own testimony contradicts herself. And that has to do with what she recalls of that evening and whether she recalls it or not. There were two different versions presented her in her own testimony. One version that she did recall what happened, and again, in great detail, and another version that she did not recall what happened and only thought she was sexually assaulted because of the positioning of her tights and other clothing.
And counsel, I'm mindful of the small amount of time we have with you today. And you have rebuttal time. So of course you'll have an opportunity to flesh out arguments at that time. But I want to make sure that we have a brief discussion at least about the issue you've raised with regard to your motion to have face masks removed the trial. Now, in looking at that, you're briefing it pretty heavily on constitutional grounds. And I don't see that argument was presented to the district court. I definitely don't see where the district court ruled on it. Is there some point in the transcript that you would direct us to see where you have preserved that issue and raised it to the district court on constitutional grounds? I know you made the motion.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that question. Yes, I will look for that citation and hopefully have it for the court in just a moment. But we, of course, did object multiple times to the district court's request to have masks on the witnesses while they were testifying. That was the main issue. We weren't concerned with the people in the courtroom, of course, having their masks on, but while witnesses were testifying, and specifically including Mr. Knott in his testimony.
Yeah, and I want to follow up because the district court did indicate that it, although it wasn't going to make a blanket exception for all witnesses, it would receive requests from counsel on a case-by-case basis or witness-by-witness. I can't remember the judge's exact words. And in fact, masks were removed at a couple of times during the course of the proceedings on that basis. So did you make a request repeatedly for the removal of masks more than this initial motion?
Thank you. Judge, I don't recall, and hopefully I will have that for you during my rebuttal time. I will look for that citation on that specific issue. I do recall the objections, but I will look for the specifics of that objection. Are there any other points the court is looking to address?
Well, you still got a minute if you don't want to.
I have a minute. Yes.
I'm happy to ask you about something else. If the panel members would like to raise a question, they should just let me know. Otherwise, the other issue I was concerned that I didn't see the right record on, so I'll just let you know about it. And again, if you want to, you can deal with it on your rebuttal. So as far as excluding the DNA evidence from the other non-present male.
Yes.
So again, you state that on constitutional grounds in your briefing to this court. I do not see constitutional grounds raised in the district court proceedings. So that would be another area that arguably is forfeited and not again, I know that you definitely made requests to have certain evidence available and admitted with regard to that other male's DNA, but not on a constitutional basis. And so it's that angle, which is emphasized quite a bit in your brief, that I just don't see in the district court. So if you'd explain that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll come back on rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you for your argument, Ms. Zahar. Next, we will turn to counsel for the state. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the court. Molly Hicken, Cook County Attorney, making argument for the respondent in this case, the state of Minnesota. I will start with a sufficiency of the evidence argument here. It is my position that the appellant is using the incorrect standard of review, that this is a case based primarily on direct evidence and not on circumstantial evidence. So this court should be using the traditional sufficiency of the evidence standard. Although I do think that under either standard, the evidence was sufficient to support the jury's verdict. I'm going to object to Ms. Zahar's characterization of the BCA analyst Bao Kang's testimony in her oral argument today about the amount of sperm cell fraction discovered on the tights and the location of the sperm cell on the tights. She characterized that as near the knee. I would characterize it as mid-thigh. And also the testimony about number of sperm cell fractions is rather confusing. It occurred during cross-examination. And in my opinion, if the court reviews that transcript, you may agree with me that Bao Kang's testimony was actually that only a specific number of sperm cells were tested. It didn't relate to the presence overall of the number of sperm cells within the sample. But I'll move on. The victim, so we have a lot of direct evidence in this case. The victim herself testified as to her personal knowledge of all of the elements of third degree criminal sexual conduct, including penetration and including physical helplessness. She provided direct evidence of sexual contact, including evidence of the appellant's sexual or aggressive intent. Testimony about MF's state of extreme intoxication and her resulting condition of unconsciousness was heard from MF herself, from witness AS, from appellant himself, and from defense witness TK, all based on their own personal knowledge and direct observation. MF testified that during appellant's criminal acts, she was unable to speak, unable to control her body, half asleep and half awake, and quote, watching it while it happens to me. I think the jurors could use their common sense and this court could use its common sense to understand that one can be intermittently awake and asleep. especially in a state of intoxication. And that those memories may be clouded by the fact that the victim was asleep intermittently. AS, the victim's friend, testified that she could not be roused. This is near the time that AS left the home, that she could only mumble responses and that she fell immediately back to sleep when AS tried to wake her. Appellant himself told Deputy Lundy that AS and MF were drinking a lot and that MF was, quote, passed out and, quote, sleeping hard. This testimony provided direct evidence supporting physical helplessness and supporting the conclusion that appellant knew or should have known of MF's physical helplessness. Her memory and testimony of sexual penetration by the appellant was corroborated by evidence. She did testify that she remembered him between her legs and penetrating her vagina. That testimony is corroborated by evidence that sperm matching the appellant's DNA was found on her tights. Contrary to what appellant wrote in the principal belief, MF did not talk about penetration for the first time on the witness stand. She told Nurse Miller that she remembered somebody raping her. Dr. Coffey wrote in his notes after his separate interview of MF that vaginal intercourse had occurred. Dr. Delfs recalled MF saying that she had been pulled to the edge of the bed and vaginally penetrated. All of those statements occurred the morning after the event that is charged. I'd also, I'm going to move next to the argument related to face coverings. I think that's an important one. The district court did have a sufficient basis to require that witnesses wear face coverings during the proceeding due to the significant public health concern present the second half of 2021. And the record is sufficient to satisfy those case-specific findings required under Motland. Under Motland and Craig.
Counsel, if I can just interject briefly here just to make sure we're all on the same page. Of course, Motland is, I think you're referring to this court's opinion in Motland, and it's pending review in the Supreme Court. We're all waiting to see what the Supreme Court does. So I guess, you know, looking at the case-specific findings that were required, discussed in Motland as required, which comes from Craig. So, I mean, that's really the basis for it. I mean, where do you see that in this record by this district court? I certainly see references from the district court to the Chief Justice's order, as well as to the order of the Chief Judge for that judicial district. But where are the case-specific findings that parallel what was analyzed in Motland? Thanks.
So the benefit of Motland was that there were those case-specific spoken findings related to the courtroom and the people in the courtroom in that small county. The court in that case also did refer to the statewide court order, which the appellate court looked upon favorably. My argument, because the court here did not talk about the size of the courtroom, the size of the community, those kind of things. My argument has to be that the court orders and the rationale included in those court orders that the court referred to was then incorporated into his decision. So the rationale of the court orders that were referenced in his decision, both the statewide court order and the local district-wide court order, did become part of the record by inference, and that those findings or that rationale, which I'll detail more further, are time-specific, so around the time of the trial. They are location-specific, so we do have some rationale in the local district court order that specifically refers to Cook County. And I have a second argument that the backdrop of Judge Cuzzo's decision in Cook County is important. The publicly available, widely known information regarding a recent death just 2 weeks prior in Cook County, and the first death that Cook County had experienced as a result.
I noticed that discussion in your brief and your citations. Aren't you asking us to look at materials outside the record that were not presented to the district court at the time this decision was made?
I can only say that these are the arguments I have to make because the spoken words weren't there. And yes, I am asking the court to take into consideration the widely known and reliable information that I did cite in my brief. I think it is especially relevant given the size of this community and the nature of public conversation in Cook County at that time, which the court, the Judge Cuzzo, is a part of, him being the only judge who hears cases in Cook County. And, you know, being a consumer of the local public media, although the fact that Cook County had lost its first resident to COVID-19 was statewide news. Really, it was statewide because we were the last of the 87 counties to lose someone. But let me talk more about the rationale that is in those two orders. Each of the orders were based on a rationale that was both current as of the date of the trial against appellant. And which applied not just statewide, but also locally in Cook County. And by reference to these orders, the court incorporated those current and county-specific findings into the decision to require masks. The findings in the local order specifically reference conditions in Cook County and local decision-making relating to face covering. The local order was made rather close in time to appellant's trial. It included the following rationale. A continuing and increasing spread of COVID-19 in the district, this was noted in August 2021 at the time of the local order, the recent proliferation of the more deadly Delta variant of the coronavirus in 2021. So I am asking that the court consider that in general as part of the public discourse, but also it was included in the court's order. The CDC recommendations.
Ms. Hicken, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm just wondering if we conclude that the fact findings made by the district court were insufficient in this case, do we still have a path to affirm? I'm wondering if you could address that.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think that. If the court cannot find that case-specific findings were made, I think that this decision is still consistent with the, the clause, excuse me, the confrontation clause, wow. Still consistent with the confrontation clause and case law around it. The court in Motland was concerned with, and in Craig, was concerned with requiring face coverings based on a general concern about the pandemic. That's not what was present here. We had those specific facts as referred to in the court orders and incorporated into the judge's findings. We have much more than a general concern about the pandemic. Also, considering that the confrontation clause does not require face-to-face in-person contact or in-courtroom confrontation with the defendant. The basic requirement is that you shouldn't be allowed to convict somebody based on a statement somebody else made outside of the courtroom. We didn't do that. We had our witnesses in the courtroom. We had them only part of their face was covered. And as Judge Bratvald accurately pointed out, the judge gave a lot of leeway to counsel to ask for additional accommodations, to ask for people to remove masks if they weren't understood. There is a lot of reliability inherent just in having those witnesses present in the courtroom speaking and heard by the jurors.
Was this raised as a constitutional argument in the district court by the defense?
No, Your Honor, it was not. I am looking for my notes on that issue, but the way that it was raised is that it was raised a single time from my review of the transcript, and that was pre-trial, and it was made as a request based on the ability to judge the credibility of the witnesses. There were no constitutional arguments made. Craig wasn't cited, and the two-prong necessity and reliability test wasn't cited. And there was no argument, as there is in the appellant brief, that the necessity prong that it was not met, or that there was no significant public health interest that required mask wearing. I'm going to spend my remaining minute and a half just talking a little bit about the DNA evidence linking RGB to the skirt that the victim wore. This was properly excluded as irrelevant and likely to cause confusion among the jurors, as well as improperly prejudicial against the state's main witness. The evidence connected to Ryan Burns was at most of extremely limited value to the defense case, beyond any improper prejudicial effect it would have against the victim that might benefit the appellant. The parties agreed that the presence of sperm DNA matching an individual going by the initials RGB on MF's skirt had nothing to do with the events on the night of the charged offense, was not an indication that Ryan Burns had had sex with MF. Law enforcement's follow-up investigation revealed that RGB was a resident of Arizona, a former resident of Duluth, and that he had visited Grand Marais, the Grand Marais area, once in December 2019. The follow-up investigation also revealed that our complaining witness, MF, had borrowed this skirt from a friend, that this was the first time she'd worn the skirt, and that the skirt had not been laundered. So we know that it's not relevant to the crime at the time. The argument about transfer DNA is interesting because the first time we heard that transfer DNA was going to be a theory of the state's or the defense case was on the morning of this motion in limine. And if I might have a moment to close up this argument, Your Honors.
You may briefly conclude.
Thank you. The appellant argued that the Burns evidence was required for appellant's case as an example of transfer DNA, but pursued no additional investigation about the identity of the skirt's previous owner or where the skirt had been during the time period Burns was in the area, whether he was ever in proximity with it or had any sexual activity around it. So we don't know anything about the skirt or, you know, if that was transfer DNA, we don't know the facts around it. There's no way to link up that set of circumstances, which we don't know anything about, to the circumstances of this case. To me, it seems that the sole reason for introducing this skirt would be to prejudice the complaining witness as a kind of a U factor, or akin to that rape shield evidence that the jurors could conclude that she was a promiscuous person or that she ran in a group of promiscuous people or friends. There was no cross-examination of Bao Kang about transfer DNA. There was no other evidence in the record on transfer DNA, and defense had ample opportunity to bring that up without the presence or the introduction of the RGB evidence.
Thank you for your arguments. We will now go back to appellant. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'll begin on this topic of the DNA of the third party that was found on the victim's skirt in this case. When the defense initially brought up this argument, we were not making a constitutional argument. We were bringing it up for pure relevancy purposes. And I think the transcript would be accurate that that was the request that the defense made for wanting this evidence presented. It became a constitutional issue when the state and the court invoked the rape shield law and made a ruling using the rape shield law to keep that evidence out of the DNA found on the skirt. So that is the point that this became a constitutional issue. What the rape shield law is a limitation of a defendant's
sixth. Counsel, just to try to put a finer point on that. So Are you suggesting that after the district court made its ruling excluding the DNA evidence related to RB, that then the defense raised a constitutional issue? That's where I should look in the transcript to find that that issue has been preserved and presented?
It was, Your Honor, it was during that argument. So the defense first argued relevancy. The state then argued rape shield.
I'm talking about your preservation of the issue and presentation of the constitutional issue to the district court. It will be in the comments made by defense counsel on the record at that point.
It would have been in that same argument, that same discussion, Your Honor, where we would have argued that this is not rape shield evidence.
Right. And how did you raise the constitutional issue? If you just explain that to me, it will help me greatly. It's a long enough transcript. I'm sure you.
Yeah, no, I understand. Your Honor, it was raised by opposing the state's argument that this was rape shield and that this was something that was protected by rape shield. So the state made it a constitutional issue when they present or tried to block it and successfully blocked it with the rape shield argument. And the defense opposed that and argued contrary to that rape shield analysis. The rape shield law is inherently a constitutional issue. That's precisely what it is. It's a limitation of a person's right to confront witnesses against them. To invoke rape shield and to make a ruling on rape shield is constitutional. You know, we use rape shield as a summary for what that rule is and what that law is, but it is a constitutional issue.
Counsel, if you're going to keep going down that path. So the rape shield law, I'm struggling with your analysis on it because of course this RB is not a previous sexual contact by your stipulation.
Correct.
Of facts in this case with regard to the victim. So it's just, you know, I'm not following your analysis on that issue. And I don't see where you've raised the constitutional argument that you now seem to be propelling, which is that somehow you were prevented from presenting a complete defense. So it may be that I'm just not understanding. And if you want, I'll listen and please give me, take whatever time you need to in your remaining time to explain that.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Judge. I guess another way of saying it is the court erred when it relied on rape shield to keep that evidence out. The defense had the right to bring it in, and the court made an incorrect ruling in applying rape shield to keep that evidence out. So I guess that's another way that I would phrase our argument, because I absolutely agree that the evidence should not have been prohibited by rape shield. We were not arguing that Mr. Burns was a prior sexual partner. We were very clear about that in the record and that our argument would have nothing to do with her prior sexual.
That helps me. So you're linking it again then to your transfer DNA argument, right? This is an illustration of that.
That's why it was important to the defense.
Right. Okay. So if it's only an illustration, I guess then I'm struggling on your constitutional and that you were prevented from raising the defense because you had ample opportunity to present it in other contexts. And the judge did exclude this evidence, at least in part, if not entirely, based on Rule 403. So if this is only an illustration of transfer DNA, I guess I don't see the prejudice and I don't see where it hits up against the constitutional concerns that you're mentioning.
Well, and why it was important for us, Judge, if I may answer your question in my few seconds remaining, is that the hypothetical concept of transfer or incidental contact, as Bao Kang from the BCA described DNA from moving from another person onto clothing or from an object onto clothing, thinking about that concept hypothetically is very different from an actual concrete example of that happening, and not just happening outside of this case, but happening within this case. We had that DNA from a third party that had no previous interactions with the victim, yet it was on her clothing. So that would be a much stronger argument, an example for us to present to the jury in defending our client and trying to explain the state's probably strongest piece of evidence, which was his sperm cell fraction found on the tights of the victim's clothing. And so that's why it was important to us, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you both very much for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to us, and we will be issuing our decision within the statutory timeframe.